7. Reuben Imperium, Centers of Gravity. The leaders of the Institute for Policy Studies and Transnational Institute have taken bold steps toward turning intellectuals, journalists, and politicians into supporters of cultural Marxism. Together, these leftist professors, reporters, and elected officials have stolen the nation's history and other important elements of culture from the American people. American public schools and universities, the nuclear family, and God remain on their collective hit list. Meanwhile, taking their guidance from the Institute for Policy Studies and its spin-offs and strategic partners, far-left intellectuals, journalists, and politicians work together fostering a stealthy program following Antonio Gramsci's formula for cultural transformation. New teachers of destruction fill their students' heads with the supposed evils of corporate America and offer socialism as if it was some sort of anti-acid to temper capitalism. Journalists tilt their reporting ever so quietly to the strategic goals of the IPS-inspired cultural revolution, manipulating public opinion rather than serving as the eyes and ears of the people on important national and international issues. Meanwhile, leftist politicians shape contemporary legislation in ways that will erode the substructure of Congress and the Constitution, as well as state and local governments, and support the radical progressive socialist Marxist agenda. Gramsci's message that a communist society is best achieved through cultural transformation has not been lost on the Institute for Policy Studies. IPS has played a major role in the cultural transformation in America by promoting a gradual process of radicalization of the societal superstructure of bourgeois institutions. The process would transform values and morals of society, which, once they are weakened, would open the country's political and economic foundations to destruction and restructuring. According to S. Stephen Powell in his landmark book Covert Cadre, Exposing the Inner Workings of the Institute for Policy Studies, the Institute has been a leader of the radical left prosecuting Antonio Gramsci's cultural war plan for many years. As a relatively unknown force, IPS has been working tirelessly to change the American political culture and bend public policy. While IPS finds no enemies on the left, it considers anti-communism a dangerous ideology. There is a consistency between the way IPS operates and the revolutionary activity advocated by the Italian communist Antonio Gramsci. For both, it is important to infiltrate autonomous institutions, schools, media, churches, public interest groups, so as radically to transform the culture, which determines the environment in which political and economic policies are played out. Emphasis added. Karl Boggs counseled his readers in 1976 to heed Gramsci's creative and dialectical philosophy, his innovative concept of ideological hegemony, and his sensitivity to the hidden dimension of mass consciousness. His totalistic conception of the revolutionary process, all this constitutes an expansive theory of cultural revolution. Gramsci's formula for stealthy penetration of society with progressive socialist Marxist revolutionary dogma and multiple actions that will lead to the transformation of existing U.S. culture is what IPS and TNI are all about. Their actions over the past four decades have made significant gains, and they may soon lead to the capture of the American presidency. They were successful in getting several of their agents of influence into high positions in the Clinton administrations, including Tony Lake, Samuel Berger, and Morton Halperin, and their man John Kerry just missed defeating President George H. Bush in the 2004 presidential election. Undeterred, the IPS Progressive Socialist Marxist Left began their campaign for the 2008 election on January 20, 2005, the day President Bush took the oath of office for his second term. Boggs also counseled his left-wing readers in 1976 that what Gramsci anticipated and what has become the reality of contemporary capitalism is the importance of the struggle for ideological hegemony, cultural strength, and domination by the existing political social order as the precondition for socialist transformation. He also outlined the pervasiveness of the dominance of the existing order in capitalist societies, most clearly present in the United States but also evident in Western Europe, Canada, and Japan. Quoting Franz Sherman, whose affiliation with the Institute for Policy Studies was through its West Coast mouthpiece, the Pacific News Service, Boggs underlines his main point. Revolutions do not begin with the thunderclap of a seizure of power, that is their culmination. They start with attacks on the moral political order in the traditional hierarchy of class statuses. They succeed when the power structure, beset by its own irresolvable contradictions, can no longer perform legitimately and effectively. It is often forgotten that the state has often in the past been rescued by the moral political order and the class hierarchy, authority, that the people still accepted. If there is one grinding purpose that drives the Institute for Policy Studies and its overseas sister organization, the Transnational Institute, it is the total, top-to-bottom, remaking of the United States, including its social norms, cultural traditions, economic engine, and political system according to socialist principles. Those persons attracted to IPS and TNI find themselves on the outside of conventional society and life in America. Their lives are based on anti-something. They always seem to be against, and rarely for corrective social action unless it falls under one of the left's oft-mouthed palliatives for social justice or stealthy cultural revolution. Who are the progressive socialist Marxists? The struggle to apply Antonio Gramsci's formula for a gradual, stealthy cultural transformation that will bring America's progressive socialist Marxist radicals to power has been underway for some time. Gramsci was adamant that a socialist revolution would have to be built through human action in order to sweep away every component of the old order, the cultural as well as the economic and political, Boggs explained. If socialism is to assert its ideological hegemony, it must create its own culture as an integral part of a total revolutionary process. In doing so, it must build upon embryonic currents of cultural protest and revolt. That means human actors must take counter-hegemonic action against the bourgeois mind control exercised over the existing working class through a monopoly of the press and other levers of influence. In order to carry out the counter-hegemonic action required for cultural revolution, Gramsci said, it would be necessary to educate the popular masses through a range of structures and activities, such as labor unions, media, schools, churches, and the family. Only in this way could the class interests dominating the existing system of values, beliefs, and morals be overturned. This is what the Institute for Policy Studies and the contemporary embryonic currents of cultural protest and revolt are all about. For Gramsci, the mass media played a crucial role in educating Reed, propagandizing the masses. Gramsci founded the newspaper Ordine Nuovo in 1919. Which declared that the aspect of the class struggle in Italy is characterized at the present time by the fact that the industrial and agricultural workers are unswervingly determined throughout the nation to bring forward the question of the ownership of the means of production in an explicit and violent way. Recruiting new members and voices to the progressive socialist Marxist action plan for Americans are also vital Gramscian goals. A new culture is created not only by individual, original discoveries, but also by the wide propaganda of those truths which have already been discovered, Karl Marzani explained in The Open Marxism of Antonio Gramsci. These truths must be socialized, so they can give use to action and be woven into the growing structure of a new moral and intellectual order. 7 for Gramsci. It was crucial over the long run to broadcast a socialist worldview through education of the masses and use of the media, including a broadly critical understanding of the existing society, a vision of the future, and a strategic sense of how to get there, Karl Boggs writes. Gramsci sought to incorporate theory into a new popular language, which is where the linkage between politics and philosophy is ultimately grounded. He explained that, in Gramsci's view, class domination is exercised as much through physical coercion, or threat of it, by the state apparatus, especially in advanced capitalist societies where education, the media, law, mass culture, etc. take on a new role. To the extent, therefore, that superstructural phenomena such as beliefs, values, cultural traditions, and myths function on a mass level to perpetuate the existing order, it follows that the struggle for liberation must stress the task of creating a counter-hegemonic worldview, or what Gramsci called a new integrated culture. Progressives label themselves as such to differentiate themselves from liberals. At the same time, however, true liberals are recruited by progressives who downplay their Gramscian orientation or their affinity for critical aspects of socialism and Marxism. So, who are the American progressives? According to the Virginia-based Culture and Media Institute, progressives make up just 17% of the public, and they advocate a humanist or secularized approach to life. For the progressive socialist Marxists, deeply held religious beliefs are unnecessary for living a good and moral life. Their secular humanism is founded on the belief that man should worship man and live their lives according to their own personal principles, even when those principles contradict God's teachings. Morality falls into a situational gray area. It is not an absolute. The individual is the final authority for actions taken, not God or the law. Surprisingly, 53% of the progressive socialist Marxists say they believe in God. But one-third say they do not believe in God, which is four times greater than the 8% of non-believers nationwide. Progressive socialist Marxists also are differentiated from the 31% of America's most religiously observant, the Orthodox, and the 46%, the Independents, who do not fully subscribe to either the progressive or Orthodox value systems. When the three groups were compared, the Culture and Media Institute's survey of 2,000 American respondents to its telephone and internet inquiry found that a substantially higher number of progressive socialist Marxists admit that they are willing to act dishonestly in everyday life. Only about two-fifths, half as many as the religiously observant, think it is always wrong to break the law. 45% think it is permissible to break laws that they deem outdated or believe breaking them would not really hurt anyone. 10% of progressives say people should not obey laws they judge to be unnecessary and stupid. And 45% of progressive socialist Marxists think it is okay to cheat on a restaurant bill when the waiter did not list all of the items. Nearly half would take a job paid in cash to avoid paying taxes. And 17% believe adults should be allowed to use any drugs, even if they're illegal. In addition, only 10% of the progressive socialist Marxists responding to the value survey identified themselves as pro-life. Just 15% thought homosexuality was wrong, and only 20% were against same-sex marriage. Centers of Gravity. The Institute for Policy Studies, operating under the guidance of the Rubin Imperium, has grown for more than four decades by bringing a wide range of key societal players under its protective wings. Three centers of gravity provide the Imperium's main strengths for use in guiding its supporters, intellectuals, mostly America's Marxist professors at universities and colleges across the country, journalists in the mainstream and alternative news media, and elected officials at the federal, state, and local levels. These centers of gravity are integrated and mutually supportive in the Institute's ideological drive for America's cultural transformation and eventual progressive socialist Marxist governance. An iron triangle of radical intellectuals, fellow traveler journalists, and left-leaning politicians provide an essential foundation to spawn a cultural revolution that would make individual liberty conditional and democracy restructured to satisfy the social and political goals of the progressive socialist Marxist movement. These three cornerstones are partially hidden in a shadow world of denial and deception. Bringing them wholly into the sunlight is a prerequisite to understanding how the shadow world operates by thousands of left-wing activists. They are busy every day, gnawing away at America's cultural strengths in an effort to implant their radical left ideas in the body politic. Today's left is unimpressed that their brothers and sisters who carried the banners of Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, and others in the last century were, in the final analysis, responsible for the murder of 100 million innocent people worldwide. These killings came at the hands of those wielding the sword of communism in one hand and a hammer and sickle in the other. After all, the hard left says 20th century communism was not a fair test of socialism. The leftists add that, by applying Antonio Gramsci's culture transformation formula, we have been able to create a movement toward Marxist renewal and reemergence in the 21st century. The open hypothetical question is, after the contemporary left successfully accedes to power in key Western countries, how many more people will have to die in miserable gulags to satisfy their idea of progressivism, socialism, Marxism? Intellectuals. For Antonio Gramsci, revolutionary intellectuals, or the properly educated masses, must ultimately create socialism. Gramsci's grassroots perspective argued for a bottom-up cultural transformation over time that would shape a counter-hegemonic political order. Hence, Gramsci's philosophy of praxis seeks to meld intellectuals and masses in what he called organic unity. And Gramsci argued, Karl Boggs writes, that to be effective, intellectuals must be an organic part of the community. They must articulate new values within the shared language and symbols of the larger culture. The revolutionary intellectuals would carry the new modes of thinking developed by the left into bourgeois society and provide theoretical guidance to the mass struggles that lie ahead. The organic intellectuals, those who are inherently a part of the working class and who are in community with the masses, serve as a safeguard against creeping elitism and political isolation. It is through this mechanism, Karl Boggs explained in Gramsci's Marxism, that new ideas would be integrated into the very fabric of proletarian culture, lifestyles, language, traditions, etc. by the revolutionaries who themselves worked and lived within the same environment. In other words, organic intellectuals would both lead and represent the everyday social existence of the working class. In Radical Sun, David Horowitz described the hard left's infiltration of American colleges and universities after the 1991 implosion of the Soviet Union. They became agents of influence for Marxist renewal and reemergence in the United States and beyond. The situation in the universities was appalling. The Marxists and socialists who had been refuted by historical events were now tenured establishment of the academic world. Marxism had produced the bloodiest and most oppressive regimes in human history, but after the fall, as one wit commented, more Marxists could be found on the faculties of American colleges than in the entire former communist bloc. Hiding behind academic masks, these progressive socialist Marxist professors, modern, organic intellectuals, have poisoned the minds of millions of students with America-hating, Gramscian Marxist advocacy. Out of some 617,000 college and university professors in the United States in 2006, David Horowitz estimated, some 25,000 to 30,000 of them were radical leftists. When one tallies the number of university students passing through the classrooms of these teachers of destruction each year and the number influenced by their radical writings, Horowitz found that on the order of 3 million potential brainwashies could have been influenced annually. The leftist bias on America's campuses is also shown by political party enrollments of professors in departments most important to American democratic culture, economics, history, English, political science, sociology, psychology, and anthropology. Professors at Brown University in 2002, for example, numbered 54 on the left to 3 on the right. The left-right disparity was obvious at other universities as well. Stanford University, 151 to 17, Cornell University, 166 to 6, and the University of California at San Diego, 99 to 6. A similar lack of diversity and pro-left bias was apparent at Penn State, University of Maryland, University of Colorado at Boulder, and many other colleges and universities across the country. Marxist running professional associations reflected the shift of focus in academe to a kind of pseudo-sociology of race-gender-class oppression, Horowitz explained. The mission of the university was now of social transformation. Not only had radical politics become the intellectual currency of academic thought, Horowitz continued, but the faculties, administrations, and departments tried to recruit students to their political agendas. Testifying before a Kansas House of Representatives hearing on academic freedom, Horowitz explained that entire academic departments and fields are no longer devoted to scholarly pursuits, but have become ideological training and recruitment centers for radical causes. Adopting the role of revolutionary intellectuals, these radical professors are working like Gramsci's fellow travelers in the promotion of actions to destroy the values supporting the American identity. Turning political correctness into a tool for oppressive speech and mind control, the radical left threatens to destroy individual liberty by imposing draconian restrictions on freedom of speech. Children are being encouraged from grade school by their teachers to respond emotionally rather than to analyze logically on a wide range of issues, extending from the environment to homelessness. Our children are being trained to be sheep and to respond automatically to words that strike an emotional chord, Thomas Sowell observed. We are being set up to be played for suckers by anyone who wants to take up where the totalitarian movements of the 20th century left off. Dare anyone express an opinion that violates the radical left's speech code about certain ethnic and social groups, thereby tacitly challenging the left's cultural orthodoxy? they can expect to have their reputations dragged through the mud and to be publicly humiliated by being called racists, homophobes, or worse. Yet, one of the most egregious hate crimes practiced in America, a hate crime by omission, is the radical left's distortions of the historical record of American communism and Soviet espionage in the United States during the Cold War. Such writings as the Black Book of Communism that documented 100 million people slaughtered at the hands of communist governments and revolutionaries, 20 million persons by the Soviet Union alone, have hardly seen the light of day on American university campuses. American revisionists, most of whom are Marxists perched at universities and colleges across the country, ignore or reject the book's commentary and conclusions. Why? Bad scholarship by the authors? No, that is hardly the case, since much of the Black Book's well-documented research is drawn from the Soviet Union's own archives and top European scholars chronicled the crimes of 20th-century communism. American professors John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare made a solid case in their 2003 book In Denial that those who hold distinguished positions in American higher education and cultural life openly applaud and apologize for the murderous communist regimes. These revisionists, as Haynes and Clare call them, see America as using democracy to mask its capitalist oppression and aggressive imperialism. The revisionists tend to see Marxism-Leninism as an embodiment of humankind's utopian fantasies, and American communists, according to the revisionists, were among the most heroic fighters for social justice in the nation's history. As a consequence of the horrific intellectual dishonesty rampant in American academic culture, revisionist gatekeepers of professional journals ensure that published writings either reflect or do not contradict the big lie that the radical professors have concocted. Rather than confront and debate new information available about American communism and Soviet espionage in the past, the academic revisionists ignore new evidence drawn from the archives of Moscow's Institute of Marxism-Leninism and code-breaking of Soviet diplomatic cables during World War II. The latter reveal numerous Americans at the highest levels of the federal government serving as espionage agents for the Soviet Union. Historians of American communism are among the most blatant revisionists. Despite the facts gleaned from Russian archives since 1992 and corroborating information released by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, many revisionists refuse to acknowledge that the Soviet Union secretly funded the Communist Party, USA, and individuals and front organizations. John Barron chronicled the $28 million transferred to the American Communist Party by the Soviet Communist Party in his book Operation Solo, The FBI's Man in the Kremlin. This gripping account of intrigue, espionage, counterintelligence, and human emotions certainly should be a candidate for an award-winning film. Yet, Hollywood producers seem reluctant to expand American awareness of Soviet espionage in the United States and the dangers it presented. Or perhaps, they just cannot bring themselves to say anything nice about the FBI. After all, to salute the FBI's penetration of the Soviet leadership and its espionage program could burst some of the giant self-serving myths about the House Committee on Un-American Activities that led to the blacklisting of those involved with integrating Soviet propaganda into American films. Revisionists remain resistant to new evidence documenting extreme measures taken by the new American communists, those of the Gramsci strain, in its support of Soviet espionage. This shameless deception of American students and the people at large has no excuse. It is the worst kind of treason, treason by omission. The sweeping generalizations, inaccurate declarations, indoctrinating rather than educating students, denials, evasions, averted eyes, and impossible scenarios all point toward academic betrayal of the United States. The military confrontation between NATO and the Soviet Union may be over, but the war of ideas between Marxism, Leninism, and Gramscism on one side and Americanism on the other goes on. John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare, two of America's foremost historians of American communism, linked the contemporary progressive socialist Marxist movement with the Cold War communism of the past. They characterized their own intellectual search for truth as an illustration of how an alienated and politicized academic culture misunderstands and distorts America's past, and the crucial role played by historical gatekeepers, such as professional journals and misshaping cultural memories to fit the ideological biases of the academic establishment. They state flatly, this book, In Denial, takes a step back to see how contemporary scholars and intellectuals have failed to confront new evidence about the history of American communism and Soviet espionage. Communism as a social fact is dead, but communism as a pleasant figment of the progressive worldview lives on, giving a phantom life to the illusions and historical distortions that sustained that murderous and oppressive ideology. The intellectual Cold War, alas, is not over. Academic revisionists who color the history of American communism in benign hue see their teaching and writing as the preparation of a new crop of radicals for the task of overthrowing capitalism and its democratic constitutional order, in the name of social justice and peace. Continuing to fight the Cold War in history, they intend to reverse the victory of the West and convince the next generation that the wrong side won, and to prepare the way for a new struggle. Journalists. Many in the American news media aid and abet the radical left's silent cultural revolution. Some of these acolytes are faceless, others are not. A few operate so deeply in the shadows that their propaganda passes undetected, or they are mistakenly labeled liberals by mindless commentators who are so frightened, or perhaps are stealthy supporters themselves, of the hammer of political correctness that they tumble into a mental gulch of sweeping generalizations. Consequently, Robert Lechter, the director of the Center for Media Affairs, notes the public thinks the media is biased and arrogant, trying to tell them not facts, but what to think as well. Some of the progressive socialist Marxist voices emanate from such leftist-oriented magazines as Mother Jones, The Nation, Progressive, and In These Times. Others, often more deceptive propaganda sources, are found in the mainstream media where slanted news helps shape opinions in support of the left's revolutionary agenda. Some of the candidates that might be given an award for lack of objectivity might include the major television networks and CNN cable news, Washington Post and New York Times, National Public Radio, and the left-wing dominated public television. These propaganda voices can be seen as legitimate efforts to satisfy two main tasks of Gramsci's philosophy of praxis, combating modern ideologies and educating the popular masses. This warping of the news is supplemented by a progressive Hollywood that churns out an unending assault against America's traditional values. According to a survey of 2,000 adults by the Culture and Media Institute, 73% of Americans blame Hollywood and 54% blame the media for eroding values. Robert Knight, the director of the Culture and Media Institute, reported that research reveals that the more Americans watch Hollywood's television fare, the more likely they will hold permissive attitudes toward abortion and sexuality, and the more they will think their problems are someone else's responsibility. 31 Meanwhile, a bevy of progressive socialist Marxist Hollywood celebrities are joined by a less informed group of their peers in supporting the ongoing social struggle to create a massive cultural transformation in America. Most Americans believe, as reflected by the respondents to the National Cultural Values Survey, the media undermines core moral values and influence people to avoid taking responsibility for their own decisions and actions. Among the survey's major findings were, 1. 74% of Americans believe moral values declined in the United States over the past 20 years, and a large majority holds the media responsible for contributing to that decline. 2. 54% of the respondents agreed that the news media has had a negative impact on moral values. Despite the denials of the media elite, most Americans believe the news is politically biased. Brian Fitzpatrick, senior editor at the Culture and Media Institute, says, and 44% of Americans say the news media favor the left, and 17% say the news media favor the right. Only 27% say the news is balanced. It is no wonder that the British leader Tony Blair likened the news media to a feral beast that has largely abandoned balanced reporting in favor of sensation, shock, and controversy that poorly serves the public. Point 33 in the United States, one could add the increasing trash journalism of television news and the seemingly unending coverage of foibles by the so-called Hollywood celebrities, such as Anna Nicole Smith, Paris Hilton, Britney Spears, O.J. Simpson, and an unending cast of others. This is also lazy journalism, since it is easy to bring in small hordes of esquires for hours of babble that takes away time for coverage of issues important to keeping the public informed about real issues that shape their lives. Mainstream media. A growing threat to American liberty and democracy festers and spreads every day as a result of the arrogance, power, and lack of accountability of people calling themselves journalists. 34 American journalists have entered a dark world of deceit and deception that support the progressive socialist Marxist revolutionaries. Bernard Goldberg, for instance, explains that left-leaning bias expressed in stories from major news outlets are more a result of shared views than any kind of shadowy conspiracy. These shared views occur within a cavern of liberal bias that echo the progressive socialist Marxist worldview. A one-time insider at CBS News, Bernard Goldberg writes that the television news of the major networks permit their journalists to 1. Slant the news in a leftward direction, 2. Deny their bias while saying their critics are really the ones who are biased, 3. Adopt a position that, in their opinion, liberalism, from abortion to affirmative action to the death penalty and gay rights, is not really liberal at all, but merely reasonable and civilized. And 4. Foster bigotry against conservatives by dividing Americans into two groups, moderates and right-wing nuts. ABC News political director Mark Halperin, red diaper baby of one of the collaborating shining stars in the Institute for Policy Studies solar system, Morton Halperin, tripped over his own bias. This is not to rest the sins of a father on his son, but it does reveal, as Lowell Ponte writes, an entire left-spin universe in which Mark grew up exposed to his father's comrades and radical ideas. Halperin wrote a memo that to many seemed to direct ABC reporters, anchors, and producers to slant its coverage by downplaying the misstatements of Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry and viewing negatively any misstatements by Republican candidate Bush. Senator Kerry was the candidate of choice for the IPS and its left-wing network of stars. L. Brent Bozell III concluded that the liberal media has become weapons of mass distortion, and he cited overwhelming evidence that liberal bias in the mainstream news media continues unchecked. He found that the counterattack against public criticism of the media's liberal bias resulted in the turning their guns on Republicans over the Bill Clinton-Monica Lewinsky story, or dropping other stories altogether, as in the case of Jennifer Flowers. Bozell concluded that the chief problem is that many media figures are less than pleased with the mounting assaults on their credibility and trustworthiness. The elite media, Bozell explained, cannot accept or tolerate the Christianity practiced by most Americans. Popular culture, whether in television, film, or art, constantly derides and attacks faith. Christianity has become an institution to be exposed, denounced, attacked, and ridiculed whenever possible. This ideological orientation shows the American news media, by aligning themselves with the teaching of Antonio Gramsci advocating a cultural revolution, in a seeming slavish support for the progressive socialist Marxist agenda. The anti-Christian bias in the media is so pervasive, Bozell writes, that a network can insult Christians on national television in front of millions, with impunity. Christians pose no threat to anyone, except for those who would foster a culture revolution en route to bringing about socialist governance that would assure an equality of poorness for all Americans. What would happen to the free press with the progressive socialist Marxist in power? Sometimes the news media are not satisfied with simply serving up a daily diet of bias, and they try to steer the course of events. When the U.S. government seized a 6-year-old child at gunpoint, Elian Gonzalez, and sent him back to a communist hell in Cuba, the liberal media did all it could do to obscure, deny, and cover up the truth. The left-oriented news became a part of the story as they demonized the staunchly anti-communist Cuban exiles who so vocally supported Elian's right to remain in America. William McGowan writes that political correctness has corrupted American journalism. Political correctness is the tip of the spear of the Gramsci left's cultural revolution, an example of Gramsci's philosophy of praxis and how the news media are used in support of the left in America's culture war. Diversity and multiculturalism are cornerstones of the left's support for Gramsci's formula. William McGowan explains in Coloring the News, the journalism shakers and movers declared that diversity was crucial if the news industry was to realize its mission of service to democracy. Hence, diversity became the new religion in journalism. It opened the door to ethnic, racial, and gender cheerleading. McGowan sweeps up the journalistic mess in observing that, By siding so openly with the cultural left on controversial diversity issues, the press has compounded the estrangement and anger of much of the electorate, unintentionally feeding the cultural and political backlash against that agenda. When the news reflects the editorial room opinion rather than the facts underlying the story, Bob Cohn says, the distortion is a problem of extreme dishonesty. Cohn's research revealed a mindset at the New York Times that makes it one of the leading polluters of straight news with editorial opinion. The news bias at the Times has simply turned the front page into carefully crafted stories that support the political agenda usually reserved for the editorial page. This reckless mixing of fact and opinion, Bob Cohn says, is journalistic fraud. The New York Times has accepted the task, either wittingly or unwittingly, of shaping public opinion to support the progressive socialist Marxist agenda of undermining and destroying American values, moral beliefs, and traditional institutions. In so doing, the Times emulates the propaganda tactics of Dr. Joseph Goebbels, Minister of Information in Nazi Germany. This rather big statement is supported by the Times stylebook on deception unearthed by Bob Cohn. 44 Mallard Fillmore, a cartoon duck speaking for the New York Times through his creator, Bruce Tinsley, sums up the double standard guiding the Times. When a story affirms our liberal biases, it's front page. When it doesn't, we bury that sucker on B34. The New York Times is not alone in such journalistic fraud. The Washington Post seems to be a willing voice for an unending stream of slanted and warped news stories that feed the secular-seeking, progressive socialist Marxist fifth column. Cross-connections between the Institute for Policy Studies and the Post are longstanding. The Post began subscribing to the IPS-connected Pacific News Service in 1983. Blending left-wing propaganda mixed with facts from legitimate news services in the Post stories, from the front page to the last, leads one wonder whether or to what extent all of its articles are tilted toward the left. In a December 1978 article, for instance, the Post ran a story about the National Lawyers Guild's, NLG, charge that Israel was using torture and violating Palestinian rights. The story failed to tell the reader that the Congress had cited the NLG to be a communist front and that the Palestinian Liberation Organization paid the expenses of the NLG fact-finding delegates when they visited the Middle East. Only one word fully describes the Post's omission of critical facts such as the political orientation of the NLG, propaganda. The Post uses many of the same deception tools the New York Times applies to editing stories in order to have them serve its political bent. The Post's information pollution passed to its readers is as dangerous to American liberties and democratic system as that spawned from the Times. The Institute for Policy Studies has long maintained good relations with the Washington Post. Karen DeYoung, a senior editor at the Post, previously taught at the IPS Washington School. She told the class of radical left activists that liberal media tends to see no enemies on the left. Most journalists now, she told the class, most Western journalists at least, are very eager to seek out guerrilla groups, leftist groups, because you assume they must be the good guys. Those words boomeranged in public, and the Post compelled her to cease participation in IPS programs. After visiting the Sandinistas in 1978 during the assault on the government in Nicaragua, she denied that they were Marxists at a time when accurate information was in short supply on Capitol Hill and making decisions on funding for the Somoza government. She said that Daniel Ortega, leader of the anti-Somoza forces, was not a Marxist and described him as a member of the most moderate faction which advocates pluralistic democracy. She painted the Sandinistas as romantic revolutionaries and ignored the fact that Daniel Ortega worshipped Fidel Castro. According to a senior defector from the Sandinistas, the leaders in the 1980s considered DeYoung as one of their most important allies in the American media. William Arkin, a longtime radical leftist, had worked to undermine U.S. national security for many years, including publication of national secrets and a continuing information pollution of disinformation designed to poison popular support for protecting Americans from harm. Michael Trimigli of the Philadelphia Bulletin, after quoting liberally from Arkin's sophomoric writings, concluded that Arkin's ideas should tell you all you need to know about the reportage of the mainstream liberal media of the Iraq War. Their reportage is biased, it is firmly in the camp of the anti-war groups, and worst of all, it is packaged as if it is impartial. The liberal mainstream media have an innate hatred and contempt for those in the military. None of this is new for IPS fellow William Arkin, who began his anti-U.S. government career at the Center for Defense Information. The center is interlocked financially and bureaucratically with the Institute for Policy Studies. In the 1980s, Arkin helped create Greenpeace International's Nuclear Free Seas campaign, which included revealing locations of naval nuclear weapons around the world. As a 9-year fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies, he exposed the classified nuclear defense contingency plans to Leslie Gelb for publication in the New York Times. He also passed parts of the plan to Iceland, Canada, and other U.S. allies in 1984, which provided grist for anti-American propaganda. In January 1982, he warned those present at the Riverside Church disarmament program, headed by Cora Rubin Weiss, of the aggressive nuclear theology of the Reagan administration. Arkin was also a member of the April 1982 IPS Soviet bilateral exchange in Moscow, along with Marcus Raskin, then IPS Director Robert Borisich, and Roger Wilkins. The revelations offered by Arkin may have contributed to Soviet Communist Party General Secretary Yuri Andropov's well-documented paranoia of the potential for a U.S. nuclear first strike. Anti-Soviet rhetoric was quite high during Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign in 1980. Contrary to expectations, it was not relaxed after the election, and, in fact, intensified. President Reagan's strong rhetoric was founded on his belief that the American deterrent had been placed into question by the Soviet military buildup during the Carter administration. President Carter had suspended work on the intercontinental MX ballistic missile and B-1 bomber. Both were reinstated by Reagan. From Soviet Party Chief Andropov's perspective, Reagan's rhetoric and reinstatement of strategic military weapons programs could well have been parts of a program to deliver a successful first strike against the USSR. The American rhetoric and military upgrades, combined with Andropov's paranoia, made the early 1980s, according to Christopher Andrew and former KGB officer Oleg Gordievsky, the most dangerous period of East-West tension since the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the middle of this quiet but very real tension, William Arkin ran around like a mad hatter, pouring gasoline on the dangerous fires raging between Washington and Moscow. In response to the deteriorating situation, General Secretary Andropov reportedly initiated a joint KGB-GRU, Military Intelligence, Worldwide Intelligence Operation, codenamed Ryan, an acronym for Raketno-Yadermoyna-Padeny nuclear missile attack. In March 1982, Top Gun Vasily Krivokitsia, a KGB officer, 1st Department, North America, was assigned responsibility for taking personal charge of Ryan intelligence collection in the United States. Soviet intelligence operations were also intensified in Europe, especially its protest efforts to prevent deployment of nuclear-tipped cruise missiles and Pershing ballistic missiles scheduled for late 1983. NATO conducted a command post exercise, Able Archer 83, from November 2 to 11, 1983, to practice nuclear release procedures. Soviet contingency plans for a surprise attack against the West envisaged the use of a training exercise to mask their preparations for attack. Thus, the Soviets were haunted by the fear that Western plans for a surprise attack on the Soviet Union might be the mirror image of its own. The atmosphere remained tense as nuclear attack indicators multiplied during the NATO exercise. While all of this was going on between the two superpowers and their European allies, William Arkin and the Institute for Policy Studies continued to throw fuel on the fires between NATO and the USSR. The Riverside Church disarmament program provided a venue in January 1982 for Arkin, sounding a dark warning about the aggressive nuclear theology of the Reagan administration. Let there be no illusion about it. The Soviet Union and its defensive plan will not stand for an attack upon the motherland, and it will respond in kind. William Arkin's 2005 book Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs and Operations in the 9/11 World includes some 3,000 U.S. national security code names, some of which are still classified. Dana Priest, a Washington Post reporter, swapped a series of undocumented stories about the CIA and the war on terrorism for a Pulitzer Prize in 2006. Her sources, if any, were unnamed. One of those, unnamed, is believed to have been Priest's friend, Mario McCarthy, a CIA officer, whose childish hatred for President George W. Bush allegedly prompted her to betray the trust that her country had placed in her. Some of Dana Priest's accounts of PSY operated prisons for terrorists overseas, whose existence was confirmed by President George W. Bush in 2006, sounded as though they were ghost stories made up around a Girl Scout campfire. Especially a whispered story about the salt pit and mysterious terrorist ghost detainees. These stories about secret prisons leave the reader with no facts and no corroboration. So how in the world did Dana Priest win the once prestigious Pulitzer Prize? Awards for rumors and fictional accounts, especially those perhaps copied from anonymous notes scribbled on the wall of the ladies' room, fall into another literary category. Priest's scary stories might not be bothersome until one realizes the damage inflicted on America's ability to protect its citizens in a time of terrorist war. Apparently, some of Dana Priest's raw material came from Mary O. McCarthy, a rather pedestrian CIA officer in her own right. If Priest was able to collect a few nuggets of information through her convenient friendship with McCarthy, they could well have become grist for instant ghost stories from Madame Priest's stubby pencil. But the story worsens. It turns out McCarthy was a Democratic partisan while working at the CIA. Partisanship is always a very bad idea for anyone serving in a sensitive national security position. According to Jennifer Verner, writing for Accuracy in Media, McCarthy worked closely with the IPS-penetrated Clinton administration and John Kerry's campaign foreign policy team, including Sandy Berger, Richard Clark, Rand Beers, and anti-Bush fact-twister Joe Wilson. Dana Priest's Pulitzer Prize looks more and more like a payoff for a Bush political hit team. Wait, the real story gets worse. Dana Priest is a graduate of the University of California at Santa Cruz, which is appropriately labeled by David Horowitz and Jacob Laskin as the worst school in America. With the likes of communist professor and recipient of the Lenin Peace Prize from East Germany Angela Davis, revolutionary professor William Domhoff, and supporting hard-left acolytes on the faculty. It is surprising that Dana Priest was not one of Mary McCarthy's reportable contacts to the CIA Security Division. And the true story turns ugly. The next series of events take us into the caverns of deceit and disinformation at the Washington Post. Jennifer Verner walked the dog backward, as the saying goes, and uncovered more about Dana Priest, proud recipient of a 2006 Pulitzer Prize. Ms. Verner discovered that Priest's matrimonial ties leaves a strong appearance of conflict of interest. Priest, it so happens, is married to William Goodfellow, a far-left political activist and longtime executive director of the Center for International Policy. The Center is a progressive socialist Marxist spin-off of the Institute for Policy Studies. One of its sister organizations is the Radical Left Center for Defense Information. Another is the Anti-Intelligence Center for National Security Studies, which was headed by Morton Halperin, who, in preparation for the 2008 presidential election, joined George Soros in his financial takeover of the Democratic Party. A curious fact about Mr. Goodfellow's Center for Information Policy is that it was created with the assistance of Orlando Leitlier while he was working with the Institute for Policy Studies. The contents of Leitlier's briefcase, which was not destroyed in the bomb blast that killed him on September 21, 1976, revealed his close contacts with the Cuban intelligence service. The briefcase also contained a personal letter from Saul Landau, a longtime fellow at IPS who remains active in its operations, to the head of Cuban intelligence. We are now left with more open questions than we began with. The story of anonymous sources, bias, and propaganda spun by Dana Priest now turns to possible Cuban espionage and hostile disinformation operations. Successful covert operations have occurred on a lot fewer links between the players than the ones in this vignette of intrigue, betrayal, and anonymous sources. Jennifer Verner is adamant in her assessment of Dana Priest. Dana Priest should not be allowed to hide behind the tattered veil of anonymous sources. Priest's Pulitzer Prize-winning story not only lacks evidence, it looks like a carefully designed and planted effort to sabotage the war or terror, a move that has put Americans at increased risk of terrorist attack. The McCarthy-Priest Goodman may be Saul Landau, Fidel Castro's friend. Cabal raises open questions about a possible role having been played by the Cuban intelligence. Have U.S. espionage laws been violated? Is this another story about a Cuban mole burrowed inside U.S. intelligence? The Washington Post's top wordsmith, Robert Kaiser, knows a thing or two about traitors, disinformation, and espionage, and perhaps even assassination. In February 1981, Mr. Kaiser relied on Philip Agee, a notorious CIA turncoat who joined the Institute for Policy Studies and whose exposure of CIA field officers may well have resulted in the murder of Richard Welch, who was gunned down outside his home in Athens after his identity and residence appeared in Agee's Counterspy magazine. The Kaiser-Agee collaboration focused on a U.S. government white paper on communist interference in El Salvador. Drawing on captured documents and other hard intelligence, the white paper revealed the extent of Soviet and Cuban arms sent to guerrillas in 1979. But Jeffrey Stein, a former fellow of IPS, telephoned Peter Osnos, the Washington Post national editor, and said that he could not believe the Post would leave the U.S. white paper without a critical examination. Meanwhile, Philip Agee, assisted by his new Cuban friends, in April 1981 provided a 46-page attack on the white paper and distributed it through the IPS-sponsored Covert Action Information Bulletin. Robert Kaiser used Agee's critique in his own anti-U.S. attack article, citing Agee as a source. An editor at the Washington Post, however, said the citation was unnecessary. Thus, Agee became an unacknowledged source and an inconvenient clipping left on the editorial floor. Given Kaiser's past complicity with the hard left and IPS, it seems to have made sense to Washington Post editors to spike the truth that was beginning to ooze out of the Dana Priest's unnamed sources about secret prisons. On June 11, 2007, Robert Kaiser's article Public Secrets was published in the Post Sunday edition. He explained the contest between press and government with facts qualified by apparently, that is to say, he offered no facts. Kaiser writes that he knew Dana Priest had many sources, but I don't know who they were. He sloppily tipped his hand, however, by quoting that the Washington Post's executive editor, Leonard Downey Jr., as having said, the Dana Priest story, raised important issues for American voters about how their country was treating prisoners. And it raised significant civil liberties issues. Voters? Why voters, unless the posts I was on influencing anti-Bush, pro-Democrat voters? Were American secrets divulged with the expressed purpose of influencing elections? Could it be that the Post's news reports were not fair and balanced? Kaiser goes on by presenting a selective history lesson on the First Amendment to the Constitution. He writes that the government overclassifies with abandoned source, and that acting as though revealing any classified information threatens our nation's security seems preposterous. Yet, earlier Kaiser, in explaining how journalists like Dana Priest and himself operate, said her article was assembled like a Lego skyscraper, brick by brick. Often the sources who help reporters don't even realize they have contributed a brick or two to the construction. If the latter statement is true, then the wall of official secrets needs to be sturdy and high to keep the brick builders at bay. Kaiser does not tell the reader that espionage agents from hostile countries are building their own Lego skyscrapers, brick by brick. Hence, the government builds high walls to protect official secrets. What happens when members of the press build a Lego skyscraper that aids and abets the espionage tasks of hostile intelligence services? The Dana Priest stories, for instance, included a Lego brick provider, knowingly or unknowingly Mario McCarthy, members of the hard left, Priest's husband William Goodfellow, and potential links with the Cuban Intelligence Service through connections at the Institute for Policy Studies and Robert Kaiser's personal collaboration with CIA turncoat Philip Agee. Were the Priest articles used as a cover to build an espionage front? Dana Priest did not cite a single source for her ghost stories. Were some of her sources hostile intelligence officers manipulating facts for her use? Disinformation is most effective when hostile intelligence officers can find ways to influence native journalists to use their carefully shaped bricks in their stories. The readers of her stories cannot make a judgment because she cited no sources. Can one be certain some of her sources were not friends of Philip Agee? At minimum, one can safely assume that Priest's musings were clipped and will be used by those who would do Americans harm. She has become an unacknowledged source, similar to Robert Kaiser many years ago when he plundered Philip Agee's critique of a U.S. government white paper on Soviet-Cuban arms supplies to communist guerrillas in El Salvador. America-hating propaganda and disinformation used by those who would destroy the United States may well draw upon Priest's writings. One of the most damning critiques of the biased American news media came from the lips of an unlikely source in October 2007. Retired Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, commander of U.S. troops in Iraq in 2003 to 2004, delivered a speech to military journalists by first blasting the Bush administration and the State Department for their lack of a workable strategy in Iraq and a long string of errors. General Sanchez seemingly lulled the assembled news reporters into their collective anti-Bush comfort zone. The second part of his speech, however, suddenly shifted gears and accelerated into a well-deserved roasting of the press corps that apparently left the journalists in silence and unable to scribble an account of what General Sanchez had to say. Neither the New York Times nor the Hearst newspapers mentioned the story at all. The United Press International and the Associated Press followed suit. A reporter from the Washington Post wrote a long story about the first part of Sanchez's speech and a trace amount of his critique of the media at the end. Perhaps it was something the general said. Over the course of this war, tactically insignificant events have become strategic defeats for America because of the tremendous power and impact of the media. Your measure of worth is how many front-page stories you have written, and unfortunately, some of you will compromise your integrity. It seems that as long as you get a front-page story, there is little or no regard for the collateral damage you will cause. The death knell of your ethics has been enabled by your parent organizations who have chosen to align themselves with political agendas. What is clear to me is that you are perpetuating the corrosive partisan politics that is destroying our country and killing our service members who are at war. Your profession has allowed external agendas to manipulate what the American public sees on TV, what they read in our newspapers, and what they see of the web. For some of you, the truth is of little or no value if it does not fit your own preconceived notions, biases, and agendas. As I assess various media entities, some are unquestionably engaged in political propaganda that is uncontrolled. This is the worst display of journalism imaginable. Our military must embrace you for the sake of our democracy. But you owe them ethical journalism. The political propaganda referred to by General Sanchez is an example of how the progressive socialist Marxist movement uses the mainstream media to help Marxize the inner American and carefully transform the country's cultural values and traditions to those that will accept Gramsci's socialist worldview. Alternative media. When IPS co-founders Marcus Raskin and Richard Barnett concluded in the early 1970s that revolutionary change was not in America's immediate future, they realized that their strategy had to be modified. Raskin and Barnett realized, while they developed a strategy in the early 1970s for the longer term, that they had to dissociate themselves from the underground press and replace these essential propaganda and disinformation voices with communications that would be held in higher credibility by the governing bourgeois superstructure. Alternative media became an acceptable camouflage phase by the left wing following a consensus reached by members of the underground press syndicate in 1972 and general usage over the years. The radical left boasts of a basketful of magazines, newspapers, radio broadcasts, and blogs that supplement the progressive socialist Marxist elite's message to the masses. David Horowitz points out that a standard operating principle of the left is the responsibility of progressive journalists to suppress facts that hurt the progressive cause and to print only those truths that support it. The Nation is the largest and most popular left-wing magazine. Publisher Viktor Novosky has deep roots in the radical left movement trying to bring down the United States government. This journal caters to members of the progressive socialist Marxist movement with articles expressing harsh criticism of corporate lobbyists, oil drillers, and fat cat executives. Hate-filled articles targeting those who allegedly trash civil liberties, as well as war profiteers, human rights abusers, and politicians whose tax cuts wreck real-world devastation on the less fortunate. The alleged underreported secret air war in Iraq and use of cluster bomb units and a new stance toward Havana, Cuba after Fidel round out some prominent national security issues in 2007. A special issue May 2007 addressed surviving the climate crisis. What must be done? One example of the Nation's toxic pollution of American society, the Nation's stooping to name-calling. Al Franken, for instance, called conservative radio commentator Rush Limbaugh a big fat idiot and said he once was morbidly obese. Advertisements in the Nation also reflects the anything-goes attitude of the editorial board. From the Nation's pages, one can purchase the Anarchist Cookbook, a magazine with the headline, "Fuck the Corporate Media," an erotic adult telephone conversation, or a trip to Havana that will break American laws. The publisher and editor of The Progressive, Matthew Rothschild, places the magazine in perspective. The United States does not have clean hands in the world. The history of the last 50 years is that history of U.S. war and repression in one third world country after another. Another propaganda spitball was fired by Barbara Ehrenreich, also an IPS member. We have a choice. Either raise all wages to a living wage level or greatly expand the government programs that make life a little easier for low-wage families. Howard Zinn adds a supporting propaganda line. We should recognize the greatness of this generation for launching a world movement against corporate domination. The cover of the June 2007 issue denigrates those who choose military service in a cartoon depicting a recruiter with a vicious dog in tow stepping over half-naked college students on spring break and urging them to look up from their beer guzzling, beanbag tossing, and football throwing for a moment and contemplate a thrilling tour of duty or two in a military uniform. The Institute for Policy Studies established in these times as a propaganda mouthpiece for the left's agenda in 1976. This biweekly publication billed itself as the independent socialist newspaper. The idea behind this IPS propaganda organ was the creation of a mass movement for socialism, one that could be sustained over the long term. The activities to be unleashed, S. Stephen Power recounts in Covert Cadre, would embrace the spirit of the old socialist movement of 1900-19, the communist movement inspired by the example of the Russian Revolution and the New Left of the 1960s. Since in these times articles were aimed at forging unity against capitalism, they were filled with articles praising revolutionary figures in the Third World, Marxist liberation movements, European communists, and radical left-wing leaders in the United States. Several American labor unions endorsed in these times, including the United Auto Workers, UAW, and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME. IPS published in these times until June 1982, when it handed operations over to the Mid-Atlantic Publishing Company. In 2003, Zero Eight, the leftist magazine, included articles on the U.S. corporate media that frustrate smaller progressive and socialist mouthpieces. Norman Solomon, for instance, argued that the degradation of journalism and mass entertainment is entwined with pervasive corporate power that chokes virtually every facet of this country's political and social life. The Institute for Policy Studies created several left-wing organizations in the 1970s. Some were far more successful than others. The magazine Mother Jones, for example, was an instant success in furthering the left's agenda with articles on feminism, environmentalism, problems in the Third World, dangers of nuclear power, and ridicule of political conservatism. S. Stephen Powell further recounts how IPS masked its relationship with the magazine in an article entitled, Who's Behind Mother Jones? In spite of the editor's virtuously asserted statement that the magazine did not speak for banks or corporations, no mention was made of its long-standing connection with IPS. The Foundation for National Progress, publisher of Mother Jones, described its purpose in 1975 as one, to carry out on the West Coast the charitable and educational activities of the Institute for Policy Studies. Powell also noted that Mother Jones had very subtly advocated a creeping socialism. Articles in Mother Jones fostered the New Left, conducted smear campaigns against the Reagan administration, and spread doubts about the free markets and corporations. Among the 2002 to 2008 subjects of the magazine's articles were, It's Time for the Left to Reclaim the Term Anarchy, Smashing Windows for a Better World, Blaming America First, and Goodbye, New World Order. Keep the Global Idea Alive. Members of the Communist Party, USA, find their way to many IPS gatherings, including those co-hosted by the Congressional Progressive Caucus and Capitol Hill meeting rooms. The Communist Party usually sets up a table with free literature, sign-up sheets for later contacts and more propaganda, and distributes their weekly newspaper, People's Weekly World. In many cases, the newspaper is given away. This writer was given a copy at an IPS Congressional Progressive Caucus meeting in January 2001, when a strategy was being developed to make the claim stick that the Republicans stole the November 2000 election. Free copies of People's Weekly World also were picked up at Robert Borisich's, former director of IPS, Conference on Campaign for America's Future in June 2004 and 2007. The usual anti-American mud was dripping from this communist propaganda rack. 100,000 strikers of the Communications Workers of America, Bush speech, defends the indefensible, stop the torture. Fire Rumsfeld, dump Bush. Travel groups defy Bush's Cuba policies, owners of gay bars say no to course, again, and U.S. companies employ blackmail and free trade with Central America. By 2007, subscription information was provided in Spanish and English, a national, bilingual newspaper with a grassroots reach, and news and analysis from the Communist Party USA and Communist and Workers' Parties from around the world. The Young Communist League, USA, says, "We struggle together for a socialist USA, for jobs, for youth, against racism and oppression, and for peace, and more." A wide range of other left-wing propaganda channels routinely bombard American society from their shadow nooks and crannies in the communications world. The Pacific News Service, for example, enjoys nationwide distribution of its tilted left news and analysis into the mainstream news. Founded in 1969 by Franz Sherman, who was quoted liberally in Karl Bogg's Gramscized Marxism, the original fare spewed by the Pacific News Service was stridently radical. The Institute for Policy Studies' West Coast affiliate, the Bay Area Institute, began to tone down its revolutionary Marxist message in the 1970s while Raskin and Barnett turned to masking its earlier countercultural message. The propaganda organs of the radical left also feed into the mainstream media, perverting the objectivity in many print and electronic news outlets. John Kavanaugh, director of IPS, told supporters in a November 2004 letter of the Institute's success in reaching a larger and larger audience with messages that help shift public opinion. The IPS annual reports on CEO pay have become mainstays for CNN, Time, New York Times, and Los Angeles Times, plus more than 350 other newspapers. IPS scholars, propagandists, Kavanaugh bragged, are also using radio, film, video, and electronic media to reach new people in new ways. The United States National Public Radio, NPR, accepts a large amount of taxpayer money and then denies objective reporting and aligns its programming strongly with the progressive socialist Marxist left wing. Richard Raw notes how NPR seemingly has a never-ending number of stories about failures in the private sector, but rare reports on socialist schemes, let alone any weaknesses. Many NPR stations, Raw points out, are now airing the BBC in part to further propagandize Americans in the socialist way of thinking. On other occasions, NPR tries to smother their guests in efforts to persuade them to mouth the radio producers' views of the Iraq War, only to become upset when truth is enunciated over the public's airwaves. Bill Moyers, a longtime certified member of the left, used the public broadcasting service to peddle his rather nasty brand of propaganda against private wealth and corporations and government policies. Moyers accused President George W. Bush, for instance, of pursuing a radical right agenda that included a crony capitalist corruption devoid of shame. In the process, Moyers has become a multimillionaire by pillaging the public money trough. Politicians. Progressive socialist Marxists are using America's democracy to destroy America's democracy. That is to say, for the left, political activity, as counseled by Antonio Gramsci, is all about the struggle for socialist transformation. Populist messages about loss of societal programs filling human needs, a corporate-controlled government, corporations breaking the social contract with working people, health care, fair wages, pensions, and greed by corporate leaders all underline the process of Marxizing the masses. Progressive socialist Marxists are using the democratic process to educate Americans in ways that will lead to the transformation of the culture and open the door to socialist governance. For Gramsci, Karl Boggs explained, "Revolution rests on an active political knowledge incorporating an awareness of human needs, objectives, and consciousness." For the left, education and cultural transformation are crucial to acceding to political power. Socialist governance in America is deemed necessary to block the continuation of economic globalization, which is essential to the United States' position in the geopolitical competition with Russia and its strategic partners in militant Islam. Democracy in America centers around some 513,000 elected offices in the United States. like a giant boa constrictor. American progressive socialist Marxists have been slowly squeezing the very life out of the once liberal-dominated Democratic Party by replacing its big government agenda with a series of harsh progressive socialist Marxist policies and programs. Despite the disputed election of George W. Bush, the Institute for Policy Studies retained considerable influence on Capitol Hill through its association with the Congressional Progressive Caucus. In a December 4, 2000 memo, IPS Director John Kavanaugh wrote that at a meeting with congressional allies, we found progressive unity and optimism on five crucial issues: transformation of the electoral system and financing elections. Universal health care. Starting with children, Kavanaugh added that this should be winnable with a strong, consolidated push, drug policy, and sentencing reform, closing the wage and wealth gap, and ending corporate-led globalization. Kavanaugh continued that IPS is committed to playing a central role in research, mobilization, and citizen activism in two major areas where our major political parties have no answers: reigning in corporate power and ending the war system. On all of these issues, the Institute's director wrote, IPS has helped put together coalitions to build unity and focus the efforts of activists on every level from communities to Capitol Hill. For years later, Kavanaugh wrote a sheepish letter on November 3rd to dear friends mourning John Kerry's loss in the re-election of President Bush. I want you to know, he lamented, that we at IPS share the profound disappointment that the progressive goals of achieving equality and fairness here and around the world appear much farther away. It was not long, however, before IPS and its allies were back on the attack. It is time for progressives to launch a comprehensive challenge to America's extreme concentration of wealth, former IPS fellow Gar Alperovitz wailed in early 2005. This is not only morally and economically sick, right? A number of developments suggest it is also one of the areas where progressives can aggressively take the political offensive. By mid-2008, the outlook of progressive socialist Marxists appeared to have improved significantly. Lance Selfer wrote in the International Socialist Review, for instance, that increased public support for the social safety net, signs of growing public concern about income inequality, and a diminished appetite for assertive national security policies have improved the political landscape for the Democrats as the 2008 presidential campaign gets underway. A major player in the politics of the progressive socialist Marxist movement is Robert Borisich, a former IPS director and in 2008 a co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, which is locked at the hip with IPS. In Borisich's view, IPS is engaged in the struggle over the underlying principles and future direction of the political culture itself. He has turned all of his energies, as he outlined in an interview with S. Stephen Powell in 1983, to move the Democratic Party's debate internally to the left by creating an invisible IPS presence in the party. The 2008 presidential election campaign became the culmination of Robert Borisich's efforts to infiltrate an invisible progressive socialist Marxist presence inside the Democratic Party. At the same time, the synergism of the intellectual and journalist centers of gravity with the Rubin Imperium at the state and national levels provided a solid operational base to win political power by subverting the democratic process. Congressional Progressive Caucus. Boasting a base of 72 members in early 2008, the caucus represented almost a third of the 232-member Democratic majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Buoyed by their newfound influence inside the Democratic Party and the House, caucus members pushed to extend their influence into new arenas. The caucus has long followed its progressive caucus agenda, including affordable health care, fair trade, civil rights and liberties, global peace, and environmental protections. In 2007, the caucus, with the assistance of the Institute for Policy Studies, began developing specific policy proposals in the areas of immigration, trade, Iraq war spending, and other topics vulnerable to progressive socialist Marxist exploitation. U.S. Representative Lynn Woolsey, a caucus co-director along with Representative Barbara Lee, bragged a bit in commenting on the clout enjoyed by the progressive socialist Marxist caucus concerning the Iraq war. We're a force to be reckoned with and we know it. The Congressional Progressive Caucus is appropriately nestled comfortably under the wing of the Democratic Socialists of America, the U.S. representative to the Socialist International, which assures solidarity with the world's socialist movement. Senator Bernie Sanders, a declared socialist and the only Senate member of the caucus, provides an important connecting link between the Congressional Caucus and the Democratic Socialists. Operational support for the caucus has been provided by the Institute for Policy Studies since its inception in 1990. The IPS provides members with bold policy approaches to national and international issues, with research showing how skewed federal budget priorities from a Gramscian communist perspective cause economic, political, and racial inequalities. The editors at The Nation explained. IPS also takes caucus members to vulnerable communities to see the effects of these inequities firsthand. The IPS-sponsored bus trips, walkthroughs, and on-the-scene discussions are key tools in its Gramsci toolbox for garnering support for socialist governance. Hugo Chavez used the same populist approach in garnering votes in the slums of Caracas that helped bring him to power. Evo Morales followed a similar approach with the indigenous peoples in Bolivia. In the final analysis, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Institute for Policy Studies, Democratic Socialists of America, and the Socialist International are working in solidarity to change the cultural outlook in America. Step one is to substitute the phrase progressive for socialism and Marxism, when in fact they are one and the same. That means, Malachi Martin explains in The Keys of This Blood, dropping all references to Lenin, Marx, revolution, dictatorship of the proletarian and workers' paradise in favor of such ideas as national consensus and national unity. This means that Gramscian Marxists, labeled progressive socialist Marxists in this book to highlight their common philosophical grounding, must participate in the normal and accepted democratic process in the United States. Lobbying, exerting clout, voting, and playing by the full gamut of congressional processes are prerequisites for the members of the Congressional Progressive and Socialist Marxist Caucus. Gramsci went further, Malachi Martin writes, in saying that Marxists around the world would have to behave in every respect the way Western Democrats behave, not only accepting the existence of many political parties, but forging alliances with some and friendships with others. They would have to defend pluralism, in fact. The Institute for Policy Studies serves as the idea house and puppeteer of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. It provides caucus members a coherent socialist agenda and bold, workable solutions to the country's most vexing problems. In its 2004 annual report, the Institute for Policy Studies described its implementation of new ways to organize our resources to maximize their impact on creating a country and world where democracy, human rights, justice, ecological balance, diversity, and peace can spread, or these activities can be legitimately be labeled as examples of Gramsci's philosophy of praxis. The Institute laid out its grand strategy for encouraging a quiet cultural revolution inside the United States that would bring the progressive socialist Marxists to power. IPS public scholars, researcher activists, continue to work closely with dozens of other groups to strengthen the progressive infrastructure in this country, in particular through 1. A new Cities for Progress network that links local elected officials with activists to build national campaigns. 2. A revitalized link between the Congressional Progressive Caucus and progressives across the country. And 3. Mechanism to link thousands of progressive academics into the public debate. Campaign for America's Future. Leaders of the American left were giddy when they believed in June 2007 that the worm had turned, the last quarter century of conservative dominance had crashed and burned. The time for the progressive socialist Marxist movement had arrived. No one was more delighted by this turn of events nor more dedicated to take advantage of this perceived downfall than Robert L. Borisich, once the organizing director of the Anti-Intelligence Center for National Security Studies. Director of the Institute for Policy Studies, issues director for the Reverend Jesse Jackson's run for president, and the president of the Institute for America's Future and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. A Yale Law School graduate, Borisich helped the Institute for Policy Studies in 1972 create the Project on National Security, which prepared critical studies on U.S. government intelligence agencies, the CIA, FBI, and National Security Agency, and collected information on corporate and private security programs, which alarmed transnational corporations whose employees were often the target of kidnapping in various parts of the world. In 1974, IPS moved the Anti-Intelligence Initiative outside of its direct purview. A new legal entity was created, the Center for National Security Studies, under the direction of Robert Borisich. The new center operated under the Fund for Peace umbrella, which was closely linked with the Institute for Policy Studies and its funders. Peter Weiss, for instance, was at the same time chairman of the board of IPS and also served on the executive committee of the board of trustees of the Fund for Peace. By 2004, while Borisich was still fully engaged in the struggle over the underlying principles and future direction of the political culture itself, by pouring his efforts into the campaign for America's future, he still had time to serve the Rubin Imperium as a member of the IPS board of directors. In more than three decades of trying to transform American culture en route to bringing progressive socialist Marxists to political power, Borisich never strayed far from the Institute for Policy Studies. As his words betrayed in June 2007, Borisich is one of the radical left's true believers. Robert Borisich delivered Straight Talk 2007 on June 18, 2007, to the 3,000-plus attendees at the Campaign for America's Future conference, Take Back America 2007. He pitched this near-perfect political propaganda to a wildly enthusiastic left-wing audience. It demonized conservatives, while offering an uplifting soaring of the progressive eagles who would save working Americans from those devils that profit from corporate success. The left would drive a spike into the heart of those who have broken the public social contract. Never mind that the world had changed and the American economy was accommodating globalization. Rather than enlighten by explaining the transition from a national to an integrated world economy, Borisich and his progressive socialist Marxist acolytes would hide behind the truth by casting images on the wall of Plato's cave that do not equate with reality in the world of sunlight. Insofar as political propaganda is concerned, Straight Talk 2007 selects just enough of the truths, which are ballyhooed by incessant left-wing propaganda to make Borisich's sweeping generalizations attractive to the unknowing. Instead of leading all Americans, including those labeled working people by the left, to a better life and economy and security for themselves and their children into the future, the real progressive promise is to lead the American people down a yellow brick road filled with magic stories, which, eventually, would produce collective poverty beyond most people's wildest imagination. Straight Talk 2007. Our time has come. Progressives are on the move. We are driving the political debate. The 2006 election exposed the collapse of conservatism. In 2006, Americans had had enough. They voted for change from the U.S. Senate down to the local city councils. Conservatives now scramble to divorce themselves from the Bush debacle. The circular firing squad is formed. Conservatism has failed because it gets the world wrong. Its foreign policy misconceptions have left us less secure and more vilified across the world. Its social and political strategies drive us apart rather than bring us together. Large majorities of Americans now understand that we are on the wrong track. They are looking for a new direction. They want bold leadership with real solutions that address real challenges. Progressives now drive the debate. Americans increasingly want the debacle in Iraq brought to an end. On clean energy, on health care, on trade, on affordable college, a growing majority of Americans are looking for action. But while Americans are moving our way, conservative ideas still shackle our imaginations and the conservative message machine backed by power corporate lobbies still stifles our progress. We need a new public contract that the corporations are now shredding. We need to give workers power and hold executives accountable to law. We need a global economic strategy and trade and investment that works for the nation, not simply stateless multinationals. Americans are demanding an end to the costly big oil energy policies. Healthcare is once more on the agenda. It is time to take on the insurance and drug industries, to insist that this country join every other industrial nation in providing affordable, high-quality healthcare to everyone. For over a quarter of a century, conservatives have dominated our politics. They have created a society in which we grow apart, rather than together. An economy in which working and middle-class Americans work harder and longer simply to stay afloat. They have left our nation less secure abroad and our citizens with less shared prosperity at home. It's time for change. We can build a more just and more prosperous nation. Conservatives have failed. The struggle for the next era has begun. Robert L. Borisich, co-director, Campaign for America's Future, June 2007.